Welcome to TYT Interviews, and we've got a very interesting interview for you guys today. It's with Kevin DeLeon. He's the president pro temp of the California State Senate and the candidate against Dianne Feinstein for the Senate seat in California. Senator DeLeon, welcome to the Young Turks.
Well, Jack, thanks a lot for the invitation. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. So you're in a unique situation because here in California, the top two get into the general election, and you're a Democrat running against another Democrat, Dianne Feinstein, that people know well of. And we're in a unique situation because I think almost everybody in the Young Turks audience knows that I supported a different candidate in the primary.
Okay, Allison. Yeah.
Yes, that's right. So let's get the elephant in the room out of the way. Okay,
there's no elephant in the room.
Okay, she's that's really true.
She's good people. She's
yeah.
good people.
Well, literally in California, there's no elephant in the room. it's two Democrats running. But in the beginning, there was 37 people running, and Allison Harson was one of them. And you were another, and you won that race. You and Feinstein and moved on. But I'll tell you why I wanted to support Allison, and then you tell me why I was wrong not to support you.
Sure.
Okay. So.
And I will.
Okay. And you will. Good. Good. So I was worried that you took corporate PAC money, and I was worried that that you were an establishment politician who would climb the ladder, and I was worried that that's the pattern that you would follow if you got into the Senate. So why was I wrong about that?
A couple things. One, let me say something about Allison. Allison, I thought, was a wonderful candidate. I love her values. I love her convictions. I said it very clearly in one of the town hall forums, in fact, with Bernie-crats of Los Angeles. If she were to make it to the top two, I would be openly and publicly in support of Allison. I love her values again. I love her convictions. And I think she was a very exciting candidate. Listen, I'm the youngest child of a single immigrant mother with a third grade education. My mother was a housekeeper. She had the courage of her convictions to cross a border against a current of bigotry. And this was a woman who worked her fingers to the bone. And this was a woman who was both a mother and a father, who put the roof over my head, who put the clothes on my back, who put the food on the table. I had never been elected to any political office in my life. I was never a city council member, a county board supervisor, school board member, community college trustee, a water board, young college Democrat, you know, ASB president, senior class president. I'd never been elected to anything, zero zilch, until I ran for the state assembly. I was lucky enough to win the state assembly, and then I left the state assembly early and ran for the state senate. These are very dangerous times in our nation's history. These are very unprecedented times in our nation's history, with Donald Trump, who occupies the White House today, who is a very clear and present danger to our economic prosperity, to our values, to our progressive values, and to our people. So I made a decision that I think that someone needs to run. And you're right, there were a lot of candidates. When you open up that ballot, looked like the white pages. There was 32 candidates. A lot of folks didn't know who Allison was. A lot of folks didn't even know who I was either, mm-hmm. truth be told. And I wasn't even sure if I'd make it into the top two, but I did. And I've been storming the state of California up and down. And let me be very clear about one thing too, because you make a very good point, and I respect the point. You know, I'm not accepting corporate PAC money into my campaign for US Senate. There's only one check that I've received, and that check is from Univision. And Univision, they're my sisters and brothers. They've been with me in the trenches since day one. They're the legitimate news source for so many Latino immigrants, working families up and down the state of California, throughout the entire country. And that's the only one I've received, not receiving one single penny from the corporate world. And I do support public financing. I believe there is too much money in our campaigns today. And I think that does influence good men and women on both sides of the aisle. And I've made it very clear, I'm not taking a penny from corporate America.
Let's talk about why you ran for office in the first place, the first time you ran for assembly. I know you work for some nonprofits, but what possessed you to run for office when you'd never done anything like that before?
That's a good question, because I was an organizer. I was a community organizer. That's where I cut my teeth politically. Back in the mid-90s, 1994, there was a really mean-spirited, pernicious ballot initiative in California, Proposition 187. And Proposition 187 would have expelled young children, children who were undocumented, from our public school systems, would have denied health care services to undocumented families. And unfortunately, tragically, it passed in California, overwhelmingly. At that time, there was a really strong economic recession, the downsizing of the Department of Defense budget because the Cold War was no longer in existence. The Soviet Union had completely disintegrated, glasnost, perestroika under Gorbachev. You had a new world order in so many words. And then in California, especially in Southern California, you had a very strong aerospace industry. So as a result of this economic recession, you had so many working families who lost their jobs, they lost their homes, the inability to put a roof over their children's head. And what I witnessed were politicians, not just Republicans, but there were some Democrats too, who took the complexities of these massive global issues and reduced them in a very simple way. You lost your job, you lost your house because of immigrants who work as dishwashers in Santa Monica or in a bistro on the west side of LA or elsewhere. And I saw the cowardly acts of these politicians. So that's where I cut my teeth politically. I made a decision, well, perhaps one of us has to run, not necessarily me, but maybe some of my friends who are organizers. I taught ESL, English as a second language, US history, civics to adult immigrants who are becoming naturalized citizens and some of them legal permanent residents. So that's why I made the decision to run for office back in 2006.
So your mom was undocumented?
At one time, and then she eventually became a legal permanent resident, but she never became, unfortunately, a U.S. citizen.
Okay, and so it's possible under Trump that they would have taken her away?
Well, it is very possible under Trump they would have taken her away. And it just sort of kind of demonstrates how personal this is to me, because had I been a very young child and my mother undocumented at this time, clearly they would have targeted someone like my mother. And nowhere is it possible that in a state like California that the youngest child of a single immigrant mother with a third grade education could rise to become the leader of our California State Senate and make it into the top two to run against a multi-billionaire for the U.S. Senate, for the most populous state in the country. That's what makes California such a magical place.
I read today, and tell me if this is wrong, and I was kind of confused, that you're Asian, that your dad is of Chinese descent. Is that true?
I have some Chinese. Some Chinese, yes. Uh-huh. That is accurate. Yeah.
But both your parents were from Guatemala.
I have Guatemalan, Central American, Chinese, and Mexican. And I grew up on the border.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So I think I'm all California,
okay.
In essence.
All right. Well, that is pretty California, I'll give you that. So, all right, so that's why you got into politics in the first place. Why run against Dianne Feinstein? What's wrong with her?
Well, when we have to sort of kind of go back a little bit. Mm-hmm. On November 8th, 2016, when the impossible happened, Donald J. Trump was elected through the Electoral College system to become president of the United States. I made a decision, albeit somewhat controversial with some folks, that I would help lead the resistance because I identified Donald J. Trump, as I stated a few moments ago, is a clear and present danger to our economic prosperity, to our progressive values, and to our people. So I made a decision that we would move forward on sanctuary state, that we would move forward with 100% clean energy, double down on our commitment to climate change. I would try to enshrine certain federal laws to state laws, like the Endangered Species Act, Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Safe Drinking Water Acts. Federal laws that were on the chopping block to be eviscerated by Donald Trump and by then EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt. So I decided to make these preemptive decisions, these strikes, to protect California. And fast forward into 2017, when I heard that the senior senator stated that we should be patient with Donald Trump with the hopes that perhaps he can become a good president in the future. That hit me like a 2x4 across the forehead. And that comment that was made 3 weeks after the tragedy of Charlottesville, Virginia, where we saw jackbooted neo-Nazis, where we saw members of the Ku Klux Klan, where we saw white supremacists, white nationalists marching in unison at night with the torches that we shall not be replaced. And then the tragedy happened the following day when a young woman was killed intentionally by the white nationalist driving his car into the crowd. I thought to myself, this is the senior senator of the most diverse state, the most economically powerful state in the country, if not in the entire world. How could you make such a comment? Which demonstrated to me a major disconnection to what is happening in our communities for young children who fear after school, will their mother come pick them up after school because they don't know if an ICE agent has swept them into detention and incarceration. Families who may be bankrupted because they can't afford the co-payments or deductibles for healthcare, the air that we breathe into our lungs, the existential threat of climate change. All of these issues that are crashing on our shoulders today, that to me demonstrated the senior senator had a huge disconnect to what is happening today. And quite frankly, our values are not being represented in Washington, D.C. today.
Well, then what do you think her values are?
Well, I can't speak for her values. What I can speak is for what my values are. What my values are is I want to fight for Californians to elevate the minimum wage like California, $15 an hour to $15 an hour across the nation. The dysfunction, the inaction of Washington, D.C., it's $7.25 an hour still at the national level.
What's her position on that?
I don't know what her position is, but I can tell you this. On the issue of Medicare for all, I don't believe for Medicare for some. She doesn't believe in Medicare for all. On the issue of immigration reform, we're 20 years after the fact. We still don't have immigration reform in the state of California. We have the largest number of immigrants from all over the world here in California. Yet our voice, the ranking member of the Judiciary Committee, has not taken a leading voice on the issue of immigration reform. On the issue of health care for all, on the issue with regards to climate change. See, one thing I want to really emphasize, Cenk, is you can say I'm for clean air. Who's going to say you're for dirty air?
Right.
You can say I'm for health care for everybody, but be very specific with regards to Medicare for all and what the specific proposal is. You're going to say I oppose climate change. That's one thing. But another thing is to actually move the measures, even if you're in the minority, mathematically impossible with the current crop of Republicans on the House side, on the Senate side. But how you organize around these issues, how you amplify these issues at a national level, how you take this fight even to red states, and how you can communicate to folks who perhaps voted for Donald Trump that, hey, these are measures that are nonpartisan, non-ideological. These can prove the human condition, regardless of who you are and where you're from. And I think that's why Californians want a real fighter in Washington.
So you just mentioned real fighter, and I think that there's an argument to be made against IFI's side, and I have made it, that she's not fighting for progressives in California. On some of the issues, though, for example, immigration reform, she'll lean on the fact that, hey, we're in the minority, there's nothing we can do. I mean, that's a typical Democratic response. But on some of the issues, she's just not with us on Medicare for all, for example. She's against it. So any sense of why she's against it and why the Democratic establishment is against it?
Well, it's not so much that it's a criticism or even a constructive criticism of the senior senator from California. I think that the values that we share are dramatically different from the values that she shares, that she adheres to. When you are born into privilege and you grow up in privilege, a privileged life, the urgency of having access to quality health care or having health care at all is maybe not an urgent thing. I grew up the vast majority of my childhood without access to health care. So many folks in our community, their HMO, their PPO, it's not Blue Shield or Blue Cross or even HealthNet or Kaiser. It's the ER room at a county hospital. That's how you get your preventative medicine. And when a woman has, say, for example, a lump in her breast, you know, a tumor that's already metastasized, and we find out it's too late because she never had health care, access to quality health care to begin with. And that's why we have a broken health care system today that's unsustainable. But these are the issues that I don't think that she's connected to, the issue of college education. And if your children are lucky enough through hard work to get into, admitted to University of California or Cal State University system, for that matter, any independent nonprofit college, whether it be Stanford or USC or Loyola or Occidental. I mean, the issue of, can I pay this college education? I've been admitted, but can I actually afford it? And will I be saddled with a mountain of debt on my shoulders? easily well into my 30s, 40s, even 50s. You know, and I think so many Californians, so many Americans are saddled with these big issues. So if you carry these values, not just articulate them as if they're talking points, if you will, you know, from Washington, D.C., but if you feel them here in your gut and your heart, and you understand the pain and the trials and tribulations of family members who go through this every single day, regardless of who you are and where you come from, then you have this sense of urgency. And the sense of urgency drives you to move policies with a sense of intentionality, a sense of purpose, because it's who you are. It's not like this is a talking point, a value that I have to adhere to per my talking points, but something that comes from here. And I think maybe perhaps that's the disconnect that exists right now. Again, it's not a criticism, but I think that our upbringings are dramatically different. And the way our lives have been shaped and the prism in which we view the world and who we're connected to and who we're not connected to, that manifests itself in terms of the policies that you move and the policies that you really move with a sense of urgency.
So you mentioned college. Let me ask a couple of questions related to that. So college for all, free tuition at the state colleges, are you in favor of that?
Yeah, I'm in favor of it. In fact, what we did is we've gone one step towards that in California. I helped, it's already in effect this year. Your first year of community college will be tuition free, regardless of your income level. So if you're down the street and going to Santa Monica College or LA City College, or for that matter, San Francisco College, any community college in California, regardless of your income level, the first year of tuition will be free. What the challenge has always been is that when people talk about a college education, they never factor in what the total cost of education is. It's not just high tuition and very, very expensive books. It's about something called life. Life is paying for your rent, to put a roof over your head. It's about food. It's about gas money. It's about bus pass, you know, all of these factors. And that's why you have so many young folks graduating 5, 6, 7 years at a four-year university. And when they're saddled with that much more debt because they have to work a job or two, or let's say you're a single parent and you have children, you're not graduating in 4 years. That's the ideal situation, but you're graduating 5, 6, 7 years. And that's why we have so many young students right now saddled with so much debt. We need to reinvest and reprioritize what our values are as a country. Instead of looking for more wars throughout the world and spend trillions of dollars, you know, bombing other countries, why don't we build our own national domestic security in California, in the United States of America, and reinvest in the most precious asset that we have, which are Americans and Californians.
So you mentioned more than tuition. So is there a specific proposal that you're behind? Is there a proposal that you think should cover more than tuition?
I think we should be able to cover all tuition. I think we should be able to cover the expense, the question of books and why they're so expensive. Books and materials are absolutely out of reach for many students here. They cost an arm and a leg. I think it's absolutely ridiculous. On the issue, we should be also given stipends, because a stipend is your cost of living. It is the cost of living, the food. It is the roof over your head, whether it's a dormitory, whether it's offsite housing, campus housing, whether it's an apartment, a studio, whatever it may be. I think we as a national government have to invest. Listen, we're in two wars right now. We're in Iraq and we're in Afghanistan. These wars are 17 years ongoing, have cost us a total of $6 trillion. $6 trillion that we could easily have spent on Medicare for all, on investments in the clean energy space, on precision medicine and finding a cure for Alzheimer's, for Parkinson's, for ovarian cancer, for debt-free college education. What's going on in Washington, D.C. is that the values are upside down. And that's why we need to reprioritize what our values are as Americans.
So one more on college. Now an idea that is gaining some steam is just simply forgiving the college debt that exists.
The current debt that exists right now.
The current debt, yes. I have to confess that the first person I heard it from was Jill Stein back in 2016, and I thought it was a bridge too far.
This is the first time I'm kind of hearing it too myself.
Yeah. And so, but now having seen how much they've given in tax cuts to the rich, I'm beginning to reconsider it.
Why not?
Yeah. So any take on it or just?
Well, you know, it's a little more complex of an answer, because I know there is an industrial complex that has been created with servicing debt loans right now that's in the private sector right now. And folks are reaping profit, you know, on servicing these types of loans. And, quite frankly, the longer that you take to pay off that loan, the better for them because they reap much more profit. So there's a huge industry that's been created, and I think that's wrong. It's, we're trying to get an education which appreciates with value over a course of time of the knowledge and the wisdom that you have been able to ascertain, to secure, being exposed, you know, to so many professors. I'm always open to different ideas and different concepts, no matter how far reaching, no matter how polemic. I never say no. I'm open to ideas and to listening to folks and getting their input.
So at least one more thing about Dianne Feinstein, which is something you alluded to earlier. We obviously have the Christine Blasey Ford Kavanaugh situation that just happened, and Dianne Feinstein was a pivotal character in that play, if you will. And she got the Ford letter. Blasey Ford reached out to her. She held it, and then it was released by others. And then, of course, she's the ranking member of the Judiciary Committee. Now, she's in a difficult position. I'm not positive what I would have done. I'm curious how you think you would have handled it.
Well, there's a couple things.
Or how she handled it.
There's a couple things I would have done differently. Number one, I would never have enabled a vote for Brett Kavanaugh to be on the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. That's the D.C. Court of Appeals, which is the farm club, if you will. It's the last step before the U.S. Supreme Court. And back in 2006, many of the Democrats were warned that if, in fact, you confirm this appointment to the D.C. Court of Appeals, Brett Kavanaugh could possibly be a U.S. Supreme Court nominee in the future. His views were already well known with regards to him working very closely with Ken Starr during the impeachment proceedings of then-President Bill Clinton. This was during the Newt Gingrich Revolution, the Contract with America period back in the 90s. So his views on women, his views on voting rights, civil rights, our environmental laws were very well known. So I would never have voted. And then Barbara Boxer, Senator from California, voted no. Harry Reid, the minority leader, voted no. Chuck Schumer, the current minority leader from New York, voted no. The late Ted Kennedy, Hillary Clinton voted no. Dick Durbin, Patty Murray, Bob Melendez, you know, they all voted no. John Kerry, the U.S. senator representing the most diverse state, the most progressive state in the union, who voted yes to enable a vote and working with the Republicans, was Senator Dianne Feinstein. So number one, I will never enable this vote for Brett Kavanaugh. So you have to be strategic. You should give everyone a fair hearing, regardless of their political persuasion and the ideology. There's no question about that. But also at the same time, to enable one whose views are well known, I would never have done that. Secondly, I would never vote to allow 60% of Donald J. Trump's nominees to the federal bench, which are not a term-limited bench. It is a lifetime appointment. 60% of judges who will now undo a woman's right to choose, Roe versus Wade, again, our workers' rights, our civil rights, our voting rights, our environmental laws. Who knows what's going to happen with the issue of DACA when it comes to another appellate court and eventually to the U.S. Supreme Court. So to confirm 60% of Donald J. Trump's nominees to the bench is irresponsible. And it's a failure of leadership.
Can I just ask real quick? I don't know the answer to this. I don't know if you know. But what's the Democratic average for confirming Donald Trump's appellate?
That's a very good question. That I don't know off the top of my head. But I would say that the senior senator from California, Feinstein, has one of the highest percentages of votes affirmatively for Trump appointees to the federal bench, as well as to cabinet positions and other appointments under the level of secretary that do require legally an official confirmation vote from the U.S. Senate.
So I'm sure that she brags about her bipartisanship, which I think is from an old era when there was a party you could work with. So I understand all that. But let's talk about, as well, this current situation. So Kavanaugh does get to this spot. I hear what you're saying about how you could have prevented it in other ways. She gets a letter from Dr. Blasey Ford. It's a difficult situation she's in. Do you think she handled it right, wrong, somewhere in the middle?
Well, Number one, first and foremost, the confidentiality of Christine Ford is paramount. That is the absolute most critical thing, is to make sure her confidentiality is well guarded. What I would have done had I had possession of this letter is, first and foremost, absolutely made sure that her confidentiality would be kept. If I had the sense of assurance in every which way imaginable that this would be well guarded and held, I would have spoken with my colleagues, my Democratic colleagues on the Judiciary Committee, and say, we have some potentially explosive information with regards to the character of the Supreme Court nominee before the Judiciary Committee. When I had the one-on-one, hypothetically, a one-on-one private meeting with Brett Kavanaugh, I would have asked him, not very specifically to a time frame or to high school, but sort of a large, if you will, open-ended question. Have you ever sexually assaulted anybody? Whether as a member of the D.C. Court of Appeals, whether as an adult male, whether as a member of law school, undergraduate or high school, see what the answer is. You get back the answer, you note it, and you put it away. There's many things that you could have done, but I want to really underscore the following. First and foremost would have been the confidentiality in making sure that we protect Christine Ford. What is sad and what is unfortunate, what is tragic, is that Brett Kavanaugh has now been confirmed to the U.S. Supreme Court. He has already assumed his role and responsibilities on the U.S. Supreme Court, the highest court of the land. And what's very sad is today Christine Ford continues to be threatened. Her life is being threatened every single day. She's moving constantly, you know, all over the state, or at least all over the region. And that's tragedy because of the leak of the information of the possession or the existence of the letter itself. I think it could have been managed in a much better way. And plus, as a ranking member of the Judiciary Committee, you want to be the lead. And we saw Young Turks, if you will, you know, Kamala Harris and Cory Booker themselves, you know, taking a much more assertive role, making motions for adjournment, more delay tactics, you know, and the ranking member simply didn't follow suit. And I would never apologize to Brett Kavanaugh for the women protesters who were exercising their First Amendment of the Constitution of free speech, even if it was disruptive within the U.S. Senate chambers. That's okay, because that chamber belongs to the people of California, or the people of the United States of America. And I would never apologize. And I think these country club rules are completely outdated with this president who seeks to undermine our institutions as we know it today.
If we get more definitive proof that Kavanaugh did do these assaults, would you vote to impeach?
There's no question. It's ultimately up to the House of Representatives, the lower house. They do impeach and they bring it over to
right. Your Senate. Role would be to convict, actually, to remove from office.
Exactly.
And you would do that.
If you have proof, there's no question about it. Because let me tackle this issue head on with the issue of impeachment, too.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't believe, for partisan purposes, Democrat, progressive, moderate, conservative, Dem, moderate Republican, far right wing, ideologically driven and charged Republicans, that impeachment, the legal process, should ever be politicized or weaponized.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe in that at all whatsoever. I believe that you have to have a legal standard. And once that legal standard has been established, then if you can move forward with articles of impeachment, then you do move forward, if in fact that is the wish of the body. That being said, I want to really underscore, I'm not into hyper-partisanship to weaponize the process of impeachment. There's a legal standard, baseline, that must be met. And if that baseline is met, then you do move forward with articles of impeachment.
So now that we're on that topic, how about for Donald Trump?
Yes, I think it applies. I think we have a president that makes Richard Nixon look like a choir boy in comparison. I think the financial enrichment, financial gain for him, both him and his family members, the assets, I think potential real obstruction of justice with a federal investigation with regards to any type of collusion with external spy agencies or nations, in this case, the Russians or the Politburo of the Russians and these national security spy apparatus undermining the electoral process in the United States of America, 2016 presidential elections. The question is yes. And again, let me emphasize, I'm not into weaponizing impeachment, but there is a legal standard for me. And the question is, how low must we go and how much more lower until we realize that at least for the chief executive of the United States of America, that we have clearly met that legal baseline.
So you've seen enough public evidence already that you think we've met the threshold for Trump?
Yeah, I think so. There's no question.
Okay. So you're also in a unique position that when you were running in the primaries, you did get some attention from the press because you're this, you know, the president of the California State Senate. And so they viewed you with a good deal of legitimacy, as they should. And so you got some attention there. Since you've moved on and in a sense won the primary to go up against Dianne Feinstein, have you met a different reception from the press or the establishment otherwise in California?
Well, you know, they have covered it somewhat. They haven't covered it, I believe, to the extent that the voters deserve with regards to the contrasting juxtaposition of our values, of our vision for the state of California. I think news media outlets, I think like the Young Turks are absolutely critical. I mean, you are the Jorge Ramos of the Young Turks, if you will, you know.
That's a high compliment, thank you.
Yeah, Jorge Ramos, that's why I say Univision for me is tops, you know, with someone like Jorge Ramos, you know. And I think that we've been using other, you know, social media platforms to talk about this race and the importance of this race. It's unfortunate that mainstream media have not given it the intention that and the importance that it does require. But that's why I'm really happy and honored to be here with you and to have an opportunity to speak to the hundreds of thousands of viewers of the Young Turks. This is an important media outlet for the country.
So I appreciate that. But when you talk about the mainstream press, what do you think their attitude toward this race is? Are they basically assuming a victory for the incumbent? Is that why they're not covering it much? Is it too much news otherwise? Or do you think there's something else at play? I'm just curious what your take on this.
It could be, you know, some of the editorial boards, or maybe this is a fait accompli. And the fait accompli, you know, we'll give the rubber stamp editorial with regards to the incumbent. We know her, we're accustomed to her, it is what it is. You know, news media is dramatically different than it was. These are not the Walter Cronkites of back in the day. You know, corporations have now are now owning media outlets. So it's not completely independent, free, you know, objective press that we knew back in the day. And not all press was free and objective, but it's a different dynamic altogether. That's why, again, and I'm not trying to toot your horn, but I think that's why media outlets such as the Young Turks are absolutely critical to give a perspective. It's ultimately up to the viewership to decide themselves whether they like what I'm saying, if they believe in what I'm saying. Ultimately, they're going to have to make their own decision. But I think that's why it's critical to engage with in as media as many media national platforms as possible.
So you're, you know, a fairly well established politician in the country, in the state. Obviously, I mean, you're one of the most important positions as the president of the Senate. But Feinstein is the Mac Daddy, if you will, of establishment politicians in California. So how has the rest of the political infrastructure within the Democratic Party reacted to your candidacy?
Well, that's a good question. You know, I will say I'm honored because I did receive the endorsement of the California Democratic Party. I've had hardworking men and women, home care workers, nurses, women and men who work the docks, janitors, men and women who are building our clean energy future in California. They've all endorsed my candidacy. 2 million strong from the California Federation of Labor, Bernie-crats, as well as those who voted for Hillary Clinton, have all come together, united, to endorse my candidacy. And the Bernie-crats played a huge role, there's no question about it, at the California Democratic Party. They were decisive, there's no doubt about it. I recognize it and I respect that. They played a huge role making the decision at the California Democratic Party, and I got the imprimatur, if you will, the seal of approval of the rank and file members of the California Democratic Party. And but you know, other elements of the establishment in Washington D.C. obviously have not been supportive of my candidacy. They're with the incumbent, and it is what it is. I understand it. But listen, I've always been a disruptor to the status quo. You know, I've always challenged establishment authority. Now, that may sound a little counterintuitive, because you may say, hey, wait, by definition, you being the leader of the Senate, that in itself makes you the establishment. But one thing I want to really underscore, that when I became the leader of the California State Senate, and I did it with a multifaceted coalition, I made a decision that I wanted to move a progressive agenda. I didn't want to just occupy a political space with a tremendous amount of power during a finite period of time and say that I'm the leader of the California State Senate, arguably the most second powerful person in the state of California after the governor. I wanted to use that political capital to move policies, policies such as $15 an hour minimum wage, 100% clean energy, sanctuary state, the Disclose Act. Now, with all the ballot initiatives, you got to put openly and publicly for all the voters to see who are the top three biggest money donors in California to those ballot initiatives. You know, issues such as public financing, single payer. We got out of the Senate. Unfortunately, it didn't make it out of the Assembly. But I wanted to use my position as disrupting the status quo and not just being part of the establishment. And if given an opportunity by the voters of California, those are the type of values I want to take back to Washington. We've got to export California values to Washington, not the other way around.
So you mentioned Disclose Act there. So that's the campaign finance reform, yep. Money in politics. So if you're in the United States Senate, what are the proposals that you think you'd be in favor of on that issue?
Well, listen, I worked closely with Trent Lang, and really closely with Trent Lang. And we moved something that I think is far reaching. I think we might have more work to do in California when it comes to campaign financing, when it comes to campaign reforms, when it comes to public financing. We have a lot more work to do in California. It's just the beginning, if you will. In Washington, D.C., quote unquote, Citizens United has to be overturned. And if I may add, I don't think we should be using quote unquote Citizens United, because it's not like the citizens are united for corporate financing. It's corporate united, or united corporations, you know, coming together. We can't use the words that, you know, the frame that they've created, and all of a sudden it's part of our vernacular. So it's not about quote unquote Citizens United. We have to overturn this. That's the bottom line at the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, with the 5-4, it's tough. With a Republican president, it's tough. But we have to work hard to get a Democratic president in the White House. We have to work hard to get a Democratic U.S. Senate if we're going to overturn corporate United. And we need to do public financing. We just have too much money in the system.
So would you support a constitutional amendment to do public financing of all elections?
Yeah, without
in the
a question. I voted for public financing in the California legislature time and time again. So that's nothing new to me.
Yeah. And how about a convention to propose an amendment? So there's two paths to an amendment. 2/3 of Congress proposing one, which is difficult in these times.
Yeah, that's true.
Or 2/3 of the states proposing a convention to propose an amendment.
Yeah, let's support that. That's not difficult.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, that's not difficult because I'm on the record and I voted on numerous occasions for public financing. So to me, it's something that it's not a no-brainer, because if you believe there's too much money in the political system today, then to vote for public financing, whatever the process vehicle may be, whether it's a constitutional change that requires 2/3 of both houses as well as the legislative bodies throughout the country, then so be it. It'd be a hell of a difficult to do it with the current climate today.
Right.
But we have no other choice, because right now the Republicans have an absolute trifecta in terms of the executive branch, the bicameral legislative branch, and right now, the feather in the cap is what they rammed through the U.S. Senate with regards to Brett Kavanaugh on the 5-4 decision.
Yeah. So, and California has voted for a convention. So it's one of the 5 states that has.
Yeah.
And you were there. So that makes sense. So you mentioned Bernie-crats earlier, and it does look like there's, and I certainly believe there is, a fight for the soul of the Democratic Party. And so, to oversimplify, people I'm sure, are curious which side you come out on. So now you might agree with their policies in different areas, et cetera, and it's not to say that one group is the bad guys necessarily, but there's the Bernie Sanders, Ro Khanna, Ocasio-Cortez wing, then there's the Schumer, Pelosi, Tom Perez wing. So is there one wing that you identify with more?
Well, I know Ro Khanna. Ro Khanna is a good friend of mine. Ro Khanna is a strong supporter of my candidacy, along with Jimmy Gomez and a handful of other progressive Democrats like Raul Grijalva from the state of Arizona, who is the chair, or was the chair of the Progressive Caucus in the Congress. So these are very strong supporters of mine. I actually had the honor of having dinner with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez just recently. We were both speakers back to back at the Netroots conference in New Orleans. So just about maybe a month and a half ago. I love her politics. I love where she stands. I love the courage of her conviction. It concerns me the attacks that she has been receiving, as if somehow, some way, she's a subversive, you know, she's a strong young woman with the courage of her convictions. She has very strong values. And she says, these are proposals I have. And these are the proposals of given an opportunity, I'd like to move forward in the Congress. There's nothing wrong with that, because folks in the middle and folks on the right have the opportunity to move their proposals. And we have the debate to see which proposals are much stronger. So I have a strong affinity for these individuals in the Congress. And if given an opportunity to be your voice in Washington, Cenk, I'd be working closely with them, along with everybody else.
Yeah, and Ro Khanna and Raul Grijalva, for the folks at home, are the first two incumbents to become just Democrats, which is to run without corporate PAC money and on a really progressive platform. So
can I add something, Cenk? Yeah. And these two individuals endorsed me right away. And when Ro Khanna ran for the last seat that he currently holds against an incumbent, the establishment authority, then Congressman Mike Conda, the whole establishment, a lot of my friends were on the side of Mike Conda. I made a decision and I said, I'm gonna roll with Ro Khanna. And I was the first highest elected official to come out publicly in support of Ro Khanna.
So that was bold, and you do deserve a lot of credit for that, to support him against an incumbent. And of course, knowing how progressive he was running, so I get that those roots run deep, no question. One more thing, I think some progressives are worried. You know, we hear some things on a campaign trail, but you know, you worked a lot of deals and good ones that that got good results in California, including single payer, etc. But you know, if you go into the Senate, then you're going to be in a different bubble, right? In a different context. And so when Chuck Schumer says, "Hey, Kevin, we gotta compromise here, and we're gonna do this, this, and this," and some compromises are perfectly fine, and some are not so fine, they're concerned that you're gonna then go and vote with Schumer on some of those things. I know it's a broad concern, but what's your take on that?
Well, Cenk, I would say I think a lot of folks are for the first time hearing who I am and what my values are and where I come from. But look at my record, too. I'm one of the main authors of the most far-reaching net neutrality measure in the country, bar none. I'm the author of 100% clean energy, the most far-reaching climate change policy in the nation. I'm the author of Sanctuary State, and Jeff Sessions came out to California to sue California because of my law. I'm the author of Yes Means Yes, Sexual Assaults on Women on College Campuses. It's affirmative consent. And I also was the main negotiator on the Disclose Act, working very closely with Trent Lang. Give him a call. Ask the play-by-play. You know, I can't say things willy-nilly and knowing that I'm going to be contradicted, you know, by somebody else to say, no, he wasn't the one, you know. He's embellishing it. No, that's who I am. Those are my values. And those are the values I want to take to California. But guess what? I cannot take them to Washington, D.C. unless we get our folks out there to vote. I don't want to be aspirational bumper sticker. I want to speak truth to power. I want to be the ones who take the progressive values and push them hard and make them the laws of the country, because they have a positive impact on the human condition for all Americans. It doesn't make a difference if you live in the Deep South, in the Midwest, the Northeast, the Northwest, or here on the Pacific Coast. These are policies that improve the human condition for all Americans, regardless of the color of your skin, who you love, regardless of which God you pray to. That's why I'm saying, look at my record, look at my values, and do the right thing, and make sure we vote come November 6th.
Well, 27 days left. You guys are going to get to make the call. Kevin DeLeon, president of the California Senate, looking to get into the U.S. Senate. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Thank you.